Well, hello, everyone. Today is Monday, July the 13th, and we've got a very special guest in for an interview, somebody that I've been looking forward to visiting with for quite some time. He is attaining kind of hero status in our fight for fair pricing for the metals. He's Keith Neumeyer, who is the founder and CEO of First Majestic Silver. He's also the chairman of a new venture called First Mining Finance. Keith is one of the really few folks that any of us have found in the mining sector that actually gets it, that understands that the current paper derivative pricing structure is blatantly unfair and manipulated and causing uneconomic pricing that's affecting the entire industry. So he's trying to do some things about that, and someone that we need to support. And Keith, I want to just thank you in advance for spending a few minutes with us here at TFMR.
Well, thanks, Greg. It's my pleasure.
Hey, I thought let's just dive right in. Like I said, it's Monday morning, the 13th of July, and I right before we started speaking, I looked up the HUI index, the HUI index of mining shares. It's 139, which puts it at a level that it was at one point in 2003, for crying out loud, 12 years ago. Your own stock is down about $4.40 this morning, down from, it was what, in the 20s a couple years ago. We all kind of scratch our heads and try to figure out how that could be. I mean, in 2003, when the HUI was at this level, gold was $350. And here it is, three times higher, and the miners are back to where they were. I guess my first question for you is, you know, when we look at this and we see the price of silver at $1,550 or so, we all talk about the cost of production for silver miners. Now, you're a primary miner, and most folks know a lot of silver is produced as a byproduct of other mining. But as a primary miner, can you talk a little bit about having silver at $1,550 and what that does to you as a business and what your cost of production is? And can you relate that, you know, for an industry as a whole?
Well, first off, you know, for First Majestic, it's obviously been a challenge, and I could probably speak for the entire sector. You know, when silver was in the $35 to $45, it was you couldn't do anything wrong, and cash flows were coming in like crazy, and we were spending money like crazy building mines, and we had three construction projects going on simultaneously. I think one year we spent around $200 million on capital expenditures, you know, just on construction. You know, those are big numbers, and this year, you know, we're likely only going to be spending about $70 million and this year we're twice the size we were back a couple of years ago from a production base. And you know, we continue to grow production. We have to, just to stay profitable, because throughput is obviously a main driver of profitability. But it's become a really different business, and you know, we had a very entrepreneurial kind of feel and staffing, and we're doing very well. The fastest growing silver company in the world. And after 10 years, we built the second largest silver producer in Mexico, which I think is quite the feat and quite the achievement. And it's now our 12th year, and we've had to replace a lot of our management. We've had to change the way we do business, and we've been doing it through technology, automation, software, and so on, just to be smarter at what we do, and really try to treat this business like a manufacturing business. Mm-hmm. And after all, you know, we are just producing another product.
So what do you do, Keith? I mean, one of the questions that always gets bandied about my site and the rest of the sites that deal with the metals, you know, is how low can the banks and the machines drive price? You know, I mean, the price of gold is kind of determined on a daily basis, it seems, by fluctuations in the Japanese yen. And silver obviously takes its cues from the price of gold. And you watch these trading machines, the HFT algos and the like, the managed money and the hedge funds, and they see silver going down and they follow that momentum and they just keep pounding it short and short and driving it lower and lower and lower, absent of any fundamentals. So What does a company do? What does a mining company do in that regard? Because your core product isn't priced based on the economics or the supply and demand. So in that understanding and recognizing that, how do you manage that risk to your company and to your employees?
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, you could hedge the metal, obviously, when silver was at $30, $35, $40 or whatever. We could have hedged our production, but you know, our shareholders would have had an absolute, you know, conniption fit if we had done that.
Yeah.
Because the shareholders don't want us hedging our metal, or they want to own us because they want exposure to the metal. So if we hedged it, then obviously they wouldn't have that, and they would have just absolutely birth. They would definitely not buy our stock. So we can't really hedge. So you know, all we can do is just reduce costs, and it's hard to say how low they can drive this metal down. I think they attempted to get it down to the low. Last year at 1430, just a couple of weeks ago, they got it down. I think it got down to 1460 or something like that, just intraday, but 1470, I believe it was. But, there is a lot of seller's exhaustion out there. Most of the selling that we see is short selling. You don't actually see a lot of fundamental selling. The producers are a very small part of the selling that goes on in the market. It's just basically driven by banks and institutions and traders and so on and so forth. So, I quite honestly don't think that we're going to see lower prices. I think the low is in, and I think we'll end this year at higher prices than where we currently are today.
Yeah, we noticed here at TFMR last November, there seemed to be almost a physical floor beyond which the metal was scarce enough that London couldn't deliver it. It seemed around 1150 in gold and around 1550 in silver, and that seems to be holding again now. But I mean, I don't want to say mothball mines, but do you take production out of production to try to limit your costs? Is that your sole defense?
Well, throughput, as I said earlier, is the primary or one of the first defense mechanisms, because you can get more rock through a mill at the same fixed cost than on a cost per ounce basis. In theory, you should improve your costs. So we've done that. We're doing that on Lincoln Panda right now. Lincoln Panda, we just turned on the third ball mill there. We spent, well, since November of last year, we spent $12 million expanding that mill from 2,000 tons a day to 3,000 tons a day. We expect this month or next month, within the summer anyways, that we'll see about $12.50 cost there, that's an all-in cost basis as well, which is obviously good. So it can then, all of a sudden start contributing cash, at these current metal prices. And then in 2016, we'll expand Ligaterra from 500 tons to 1,000 tons, and we expect the same impact there at about a $5 an ounce savings. So, the other thing is high grading. You can't mine 100 grams silver anymore and make a profit on it. You need to be mining 200 grams silver and higher to make a profit. So that restricts the amount of mining that you can do. So if you have sustained long-term low metal prices, there's only a certain amount of this higher grade material available. So you have to start reducing the size of the operations in order to keep going, because shutting them down is very, very problematic. So it's much easier than to just reduce the size of them than to shut them down.
Got it. Yeah, I guess I've heard other folks say that. It does in the end, brutal as it seems, I guess, it does eventually create opportunity. I mean, I'm a shareholder. I think what you do is great. I think what First Majestic does is great. And it's a tremendous opportunity at $4.40 a share. But there are properties and mining companies out there that are way more distressed than what you've been able to do and keep together at First Majestic. And I think to that end, if I understand it right, that's what First Mining Finance is about, right? Where you're working with Rick Rule, who I just visited with a couple of weeks ago, Eric Sprott, Marion Katusa, and others, to acquire, right? Kind of in the, almost like a fund structure, distressed properties. Is that what First Mining Finance is about? Or can you explain that a little bit? Because I think it's a neat idea.
Yeah, sure. We've got some great shareholders, as you just laid out, and many more very good shareholders as well. Shareholders that have been following my career for the last 30 years. And one thing I noticed during that period of time investors may or may not know this, but the acquisitions that I made, I formed a company called First Quantum Minerals back in the early 90s. It's today, multi-billion-dollar copper company, and then I put First Majestic Silver together in 2002, 2003. And then First Mining Finance, I just put together a couple months ago after 2 years of fairly rigorous work, merging three private companies together to get its portfolio and so on. But what the similarity between those three companies are is I was buying, I am now in First Mining's case, but was in First Quantum's and First Silver, First Pacific Silver's case, buying assets when no one wanted them. And the prices that I paid for projects back in 2003, 2004, when I was putting First Pacific together, was absolutely unbelievable. And, I said earlier that, we're the second largest silver producer in Mexico, and we came out of nowhere. And of the five producing mines that we currently are operating in Mexico, four of them I bought over an 18-month period from January 2004 to June of 2006 when no one wanted them.
Right.
There was no competition, and no one wanted to even invest in mining. It's the same situation today. There's an absolute hate on the mining industry. No one wants to own mining. The investors are getting me out of this. I'm never going to own another mining stock again. But, that turns me on. I think that tells me that now time to be putting another company together. So we've gone through, close to 1,000 of the companies listed in Canada, the mining companies, and we've defined a whole handful of interesting targets that we think are extremely undervalued that we could monetize over the next cycle and make a substantial amount of money for our investors and our shareholders. And I'm doing this to build another billion-dollar company. I'm not doing it just for giggles. I'm very serious about this. We've now taken out one company called Coastal Gold. I'm actually in Toronto right now flying to the Hope Book project tomorrow, which is in Newfoundland. It's a very, very good project, and our technical people are very excited about it. It's one of the best projects in Canada, and we were able to acquire it for $12 million just over the last couple of months. It was quite the battle, but we pulled it off, and we got our eyes on some other targets, and investors can see the news coming out in the next couple of months as we build this business.
Are the shares available yet, or how does someone invest in First Mining?
The shares trade. The symbol is FF, and it trades on the Toronto Venture Exchange, so TSXVFF, and it also trades on the Pink Sheets. I actually forget the symbol, FFMGF, I believe it is, but it's not really quoted properly. It's still on the pinks. We've applied for an OTCQX listing, so it should be fully listed in the U.S. within the next 30 to 60 days type of thing.
Wonderful, wonderful. So Canadians at least can find it now in the Toronto Venture Exchange. And then hopefully by this fall, you will see it somewhere listed in the U.S., make it easy for someone to purchase it as well.
Well, it does trade pretty good volume on the pink, surprisingly.
Okay.
You can't really see a market, though, unfortunately.
It's just, right.
All you do is just see the volume going through, so it's a little bit crazy, actually. But, your listeners can go and look at the quote in Canada, and then if they care to, they can also go and do what they need to do on the U.S. side.
Well, I tell you, geez, Keith, with your experience and Rick's and Eric's, and with, like you said, I mean, the time is just like it was in the mid-2000s. Everybody hates the miners. They hate the metals. Whenever there's blood in the streets, it seems to be that's about the best time to do the accumulating. And, what a great idea. You're being very generous with your time. I want to just ask you a couple more questions, if that's all right.
Yep.
There are a couple of things that have brought your name to the forefront over the last 12 months or so. The first thing that I recall seeing was your idea of, I don't know if forming a cartel is too strong of a term, but you wanted to get some of the silver miners together to basically hold back production at these prices. Did you ever get anybody to say, damn, Keith, that's a good idea. We ought to fight back.
Well, unfortunately not. We've held back production on a couple of occasions, but we're even though we're a large producer, we're small in the whole scheme of things. It's 800 million ounces of silver mined a year, and we produce 15 million of it. So, it's hard for us to make a real impact, but we have done it on a couple of occasions. We've made put news releases out and told the world that we're doing this, and I've tried to get other mining companies to come to the table. I actually picked June of 2015 as the month that all the silver producers would suspend sales, you know, I was hoping I was going to get calls, but I never did.
What do you think? What's the deal? I mean, you get it, obviously, and you're forward thinking enough and understand what's going on to see through this pricing structure. I'm not trying to get you to say bad things about your competitors or anything like that. But why is it that no other mining CEOs or mining companies seem to understand how unfairly the paper derivatives market is structured to work against them?
Well, I actually don't think I understand the product that they're actually producing and selling. There's really no other explanation for it. I think they just, you know, in a lot of cases, geologists or engineers and maybe very good at that. But you know, when it comes to, you know, understanding what they're actually producing, it's just they're very focused getting out of the ground and selling it and making, hopefully making a profit on it, and that's really all they care about. And you know, when it comes to these kinds of things, they just rather leave it to the banks or leave it to the investors to deal with.
So they just kind of accept the electronic price that they see go across on CNBC as being some kind of fair price. Huh? They just think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Then I guess that leads me to my second question. Again, this is what drives me crazy is this lack of understanding of how that paper price is derived and the banks that control it by issuing the paper contracts. You know, it's not as if like your stock, your First Majestic stock has a float that's out there every day. And if there's more buyers than sellers, the price goes up, right? I mean, that's pretty much how it works. Yep. But in the paper, gold, and silver markets, if there's more buyers than sellers, the banks just simply provide more supply and limit the price run so that the momentum doesn't change. It doesn't begin a virtuous cycle of rising prices and more buying. It's totally unfair, and it's against the way that the commodity markets were set up in the first place to help producers manage their risk, not to give speculators a place to play. You contacted and wrote the CFTC about a month ago complaining about the size of the managed money short position, complaining about the concentration of the position, and that it seemed like eight large traders, speculating funds and banks, basically manipulating and control the whole market. I'll make sure I post a link to that here in this podcast page. But I guess my follow up question is: did you ever hear anything from the CFTC? You've got a pretty big job as a CEO of a mining company. Did they get back to you at all?
Do you have to ask?
Seriously?
No, they haven't. It would be nice. Maybe they're behind closed doors and thinking about how to respond. I hope to get a response one day, but I'm not certain if I ever will. But yeah, it is ridiculous.
So, Keith, let me see if I got this straight. The paper derivative markets are set up so primarily for producers of a commodity to have a place to go to sell forward, buy forward, manage their risks, all that kind of stuff. And then the speculators take the other side of those trades, long and short, to make a market. You write to the American, regulatory body that's supposed to regulate, manage these markets, the CFTC. You write them, tell them that you're concerned that there's manipulation and concentration positions going on, and they don't even write you back and say, hey, thanks for getting in touch with us?
Yeah, no, unfortunately not. It hasn't happened yet, and I'm optimistic that it will happen. But yeah, 15 million ounces makes us the number two producer in Mexico. We're about the fifth largest in the world.
Gotcha. Again, enough for crying out loud that you come to this regulatory body alleging the most egregious of market crimes, which is manipulation and concentration of position that allows manipulation, and you get crickets? Goodness gracious.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. You have a market where it's trading, a billion ounces of silver a year, a billion ounces of silver in a single day, and sometimes more than that. And, miners produce 800 million ounces of silver in an entire year. So the leverage is something like, 400 to 1 or something. So how can you have price discovery when there's leverage like that?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned being optimistic you'll hear from them. I mean, what would it mean to you if you just never hear from them? I mean, do you write them again? What would it signify to you if you never hear anything?
They probably get a lot of people writing them, about silver and about gold and I'm sure other commodities as well. So I don't know. They probably just have a back room where all these letters go, and they probably just all get put in a box and ignored. So I don't really ever expect it.
Oh, my friend, you're being very generous. All right, I want to ask you one more question, and then again, I thank you for your time. The thing that makes me the most crazy about this entire pricing structure, I mean, beside the fact that prices are clearly multiples lower than they should be, and the power that it hands the banks, and the banks know the books, and they lead the speculators into out of position, all that kind of stuff. The thing that drives me the most crazy is, at the end of the day, it's affecting real people with real jobs. You talk about being one of the largest silver producers in Mexico. You can go all through Mexico, Central America, and find all kinds of individuals and families which would otherwise have good-paying jobs, high-quality jobs. You can go all the way, apply a political component. Maybe you wouldn't have to leave that part of the world to come, and immigrate to the U.S. or someplace else if you had a good job there. And because the price of silver has been driven so low, the mining companies, their employees, their miners are losing their jobs. And it is something that seems like nobody ever seems to really think about. It's totally unfair. We hope and plan for a day when this type of pricing structure becomes obsolete and goes away for whatever reason. If you could, Keith Neumeyer, if somebody gave you the magic wand and gave you the opportunity to just change how this is done, what changes would you make? How would you set it up to price silver so that you would actually recognize the fundamentals?
Well, I think it's quite simple. I would fix the leverage. I would come up with a number, let's say 10 to 1. I think that's probably a fair number.
Okay.
For example, the banks, your local bank that you deal with has to have a certain amount of cash on deposit every day to meet withdrawal demands. And by law, they have to have a certain amount of liquid capital available. And the COMEX does not have that. And I think if we change the law to force the COMEX into having a certain amount of silver on hand for every single contract that is written, then that fixes the problem.
I would say that's true. Again, part of what you wrote the CFTC about, obviously, is this huge short position by managed money and hedge fund speculators that don't have silver. I mean, it's not like they're planning to deliver silver at some date in the future. They're just simply naked short. So if we remove the leverage or tied the leverage to the amount of eligible or registered gold in the COMEX vaults and set the multiple at a certain level, maybe we could still use the current system or at least some leverage, but at least limit what that leverage would be.
It would limit the supply of the paper. And then when buying or selling actually did go into the market would change according to supply-demand fundamentals. And if you want to go and buy 1,000 ounces of silver on the COMEX, in my view, in my mind, should have 100 ounces of silver in their vault as a backup to your contract.
Makes sense to me, and I like your idea. I mean, if fractional reserve banking is the structure, then at least have it the way we do it with paper, 10 to 1. That makes good sense. Keith, it's been a real pleasure to visit with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to stop by TF Metals Report. Again, First Majestic Silver is your company, but you've also got First Mining Finance. You're hoping it's available now on the pink sheets in the U.S., but hopefully we'll see a little more visibility for that in the months ahead.
That's correct. Yeah, it's going. There'll be a full QX or OTC. QX listing happen in the next 30 to 60 days.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye out for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've said many times, when a sector is so unloved and so hated, it's a sector that's got to be looked at. But your listeners need to take a long-term approach to this. So you're not going to be, seeing, in my view anyways, 20, 30, 40, 50% gains in this market anytime soon. You have to pick good quality companies and take on decent positions and basically just, close your eyes. And as long as the company has got good management and has got a good business plan, this is the sector to be buying right now. And it blows me away. I was looking at fund holdings, some of the hedge funds out there in Vancouver. I was just looking at a list on Friday, and every single one of these hedge funds owns the same companies, you know, Apple, Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah.
You name it. They all have, and they all have different mandates, yet they all own the same stocks. And it's just shocking. And then not a single mining company, not a single resource company, no oil and gas companies, everything is just unowned. And that's, you know, the stuff I think you have to buy.
Especially with all the money printing going on, you sure would think there'd be more of an appreciation of the potential for hard assets, you know, tangible things, but it doesn't. We're not at that point at this time, but I think most everybody listening to you and I speak recognizes that the value that's there, and the endorsement I'd give is, gosh, rather than me sitting out here in the middle of nowhere trying to page through company reports and 10-Ks and everything else, trying to see which companies to buy at which distress level, let the professionals like you and Rick and Eric do it, for crying out loud. You guys are more qualified to pick them than I am.
Well, that's one of the great things of the funds like our business plan for First Mining Finance, because, you know, if they want to buy a mining stock, you know, it's very, very tough for them to really understand and know which is the best mining stock to buy. You know, a lot of times they buy it, and then a couple of years later they're down, you know, 70-80%, and they go, geez, what happened? And, you know, they just don't understand the industry. So, you know, we've got a great team. We've been in this business for our entire careers. We've, you know, built big businesses before, you know, two back-to-back, you know, multi-billion-dollar companies. And, you know, we think we can do it again. And, you know, we take the risk away from the fund manager to make that decision on what individual company to buy. They can buy us, and we're basically their ETF, as you mentioned earlier.
Well, Keith, God bless you, my friend. We sure appreciate you picking up the flag and running with it to the extent that you have. And anytime we here at TF Metals Report or anything else can do to help promote the cause, we're going to do it. So keep on fighting the fight, and we'll look forward to seeing some wider visibility for First Mining Finance, and we'll continue to buy First Majestic, and we'll all get through this together. Thanks for your time this morning. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Greg. Appreciate your time.
Have a great rest of your week.
Thank you.